All right, we're beginning here on the top of Yud Aleph Umed Aleph. Unculus Bar Colonimus. This is the famous Unculus Targum Unculus that we know on the Chumash. Igayer. He was a Roman convert. He was politically connected. The Caesar was not happy about his conversion. Shadar Kesar Gunda de Romai Abatre. The Roman Kesar sent a Roman legion to go and pick him up. Mashchinu Bikrai. He convinced them through Psukim that this was the right way. Igiyur, and they converted the whole legion. Hadar Shadar Gunda de Romaya Harina. Abatre. Caesar sends another legion after him to pick him up. Amar Lehu, Lo Timrle Velomide. Don't say a word to him, don't speak to him. That way we don't get into any trouble. Kihavu Shaklavazlu. So they were going along the way. Amar Lehu, Emelechu Milta Dalma. Let's just speak in general. We don't have to speak in Torah, but let's at least have some conversation here. Gifyora nakat nura kame pifyora. There's going to be a hierarchy over here. We're starting from the lowest person on the totem pole, moving up to the highest person on the totem pole. So when it comes to these individuals, the deputy carries the torch in front of the official. So someone who's of a lower stature is the one who carries the torch or goes in front of this individual. Pifyora l'duchsa. And the official does it for the mayor, duchsa l'hagmona, and then the mayor does that for the governor, hagmona l'koma, and the governor does it for the king. Not sure if the translations are exact, just a hierarchy that we're speaking about here, but each individual does this for the person that's of a higher stature than he. Kuma minakat nura mikame inche. Does the king then carry the torch in front of regular people, lay people, the plebiscite? Amrilelo, of course not. That doesn't make sense. The king never does that. That's why he's the king, and that's he has the highest status. Amrilelo, Kodesh Baruch Hu Naka Nura Kame Yisrael. Hashem took a fire in front of Klal Yisrael. Dichtiv, Min Yonah Dioma. Hashem Olech Lifnehem Yomam. During the day, he went with him Banan Ve Amudesh Laila. And he went to fire at night. You see that Kodesh Baruch Hu, who is the king, he's carrying a fire before Bnei Yisrael, which is indicative of the stature of Bnei Yisrael. Igayur Kulu. They all converted. Hadar Shadar Gundach Rina Batre. Then they sent another legion after him. Amar Lehu Lo Tishto Mide Vade. Forget about conversations in Torah. You can't speak to him at all. Inaktele Vazle. They were bringing him back to the Caesar. Chazam Mezuzah De Mancha Pitcho. They saw a mezuzah that was up on one of the doorways. Otiv Yadei Allah. He put his hand on it. Amar Lehu Mai Hai. He said to them, what is this? Amrulay, they said to him, Emelechat, you tell us. We don't know what it is. Why don't you tell us what it is? Amrulay, Minagoshel Olam, the way that most places work, Melech Basar Vadam Yoshev Bibifnim. The king sits on the inside. Vavadav Mishamrim Otovi Bachutz. And his servants are outside protecting him. They are the guards for the king on the inside. Vilo Kodesh Baruch Hu, Avadav Nibifnim, Vehu Mishamram Bibachutz. Whereas by the Jews, by the servants of Hashem, they sit inside the house, and Hashem provides the protection on the outside, the mezuzah. Shenamar, Hashem yishmor tzeitcha v'echa me'ata v'yadolam. That Hashem protects you in your going and your coming. Obviously, a reference to the mezuzah at the petach of the door of your going and coming. That Hashem provides you that protection. Igoyor, they all converted as well. Tulo shadar batre. They had enough. They didn't send after him anymore. It's interesting, Gemara in general. Only because Judaism in general is not a proselytizing type of religion. So it's interesting that they speak about it in this manner, which is that he's convincing all these legions to convert. One way to deal with it is to say what you are suggesting, which is that this is describing Unculus's thought process. This is really describing what convinced him or what drew him. And it's just done through a story of convincing the legions that are coming to him. The other possibility is that the restriction against proselytizing only applies to a Bar Yisrael. But a Ger himself who converts might have the ability or the capacity or the right to speak to others about his process and about what convinced him and maybe even convince others to convert. Or you could say that there was, at that period of time in the Roman Empire, a great disenfranchisement with the Avodah Zarah, and there were huge amounts of converts that were going on. Most of them later on to Christianity, but Judaism also saw its fair share of converts at the time because they were looking for something besides the Avodah Zarah. And this is describing something along those lines, which is that they were people searching. And Unkelos found it, and then he's sharing with others what he found over here, and they're finding the same benefit or what he saw, they're also seeing now. So then, Vayomer Hashem, da, Shnei goyim bivitnech, Shnei lumim imayich yiparedu, Ulom yom yamatz, Rav yabod zeir, that is what Hashem says to Rivka with regards to the pain that she's feeling during her pregnancy. Amar Yudam Rav, al tikri goyim, ela geyim. Don't read it as goyim, but rather geyim. Don't read it as nations, but rather read it as those that are exalted. Now the truth is, it's a Korean aktiv. The pasuk has written in it, gimel yud yud mem. We pronounce it goyim. As Rashi notes over here, that the drasha here is not your typical al tikri type of drasha where they're playing on a word. It's really the Korean aktiv. And what they really are doing is darshaning the aktiv, which is geyim. And so it says, don't read it as goyim, el geyim. Ze Antoninus v'Rabi. This is the story of Antoninus and Rabi. Shlo pasku mi'al shulchanam. That their tables were never shored up. Lo chazeret, not lettuce. Velo kishut, and not gourds. Whether it's zucchini, cucumber, gourds, whatever they're using the word for. Velo tsunon, and not radishes. Lo bimot hachama, velo bimot hagishamim. Not in the summertime. Not in the winter time. We'll speak about what was on their table in a second. In terms of the drasha on the pasuk, what they're suggesting here is Rabbi, who's a descendant of Yaakov, Antoninus, the Roman Caesar, who's a descendant of Esav. The fact that they were cooperating very close and actually had a very tight relationship, they were like twins, similar to Yaakov and Esav. And over here you see that they're going to be Shnei Goyim. There'll be two exalted, two leaders that are emerged from you that will be like twins. And that's just reference to Antoninus and to Rabbi. Especially the Gemara says about Rabbi, they never found Dula v'Torah b'makom echad. They never had someone who had both the political power, the wealth, and the Torah erudition in one place. I mean, Rabbi was unique in that way as a Nasi of Eretz Yisrael. That's why he also has the power and clout to be Mesader the Mishnah, because of that status that he held. And Antoninus, obviously, on the other side, being the head of the Roman Empire, also carried tremendous weight. And the fact that they were cooperating, or that they had this relationship, is being reflected in this Shnei Goyim, rather than it being two nations, but they're Geyim, two individuals, two exalted individuals that would be there. And again, similar to Yaakov and Esav, who are twins, but here in a cooperative manner, rather than in the competitive manner that we know of, and we'll see it later on in today's daf. Now, in terms of what was on their table, the Gemara says, Damar Mar, Tznon Michateich Ochel. When it comes to radish, it is good for digestion. It crushes up or minces the other food. Chazeret Mapech Ma'achal. Lettuce helps to turn over the other food, stir it. Kishot Marchib Me'ayim. Kishot helps to expand your waistline, or give you room to eat. V'hatana debei Rabbi Yishmo. Lama nikra shman kishuin. Why are they called kishuin? Mipnei shekashin legufo shel adam. Ker charavot. They're not good for you. That they are difficult for one's body, like swords or like daggers. Lokasha ha biravrave ha bizutre. You can read this one of two ways. You can read it when you eat a lot of them, it's bad for you. If you eat small amounts, it's good for you. Or it could be a reference to the size of the gourd, or the size of the cucumber or zucchini. The larger one is not good for you. The smaller one is good for you. And that is true today as well, that large cucumbers are not as nutritious or not as good for a person than the small cucumbers. And that's because the larger these items are, the gourds or the cucumbers, the more water they contain. And therefore, they contain less nutritious content to them. That would be an explanation of Habrabave Habizutre. So now, here the suggestion is that this was some demonstration of their tremendous wealth, which was that they had chazeret, kishot, and snow, both in the winter and the summertime, which means that even out of season, they didn't just have them when they were in season, they had them when they were eating out of season. And we'll see that the Baalei Tosafot already asked, why is it that that was something special if when they're out of season, they're actually not so good for you? So that's what he brings in the top Tosafot. Ba'av demin ha'beketzed ma'arvin. Niret snon, niret sam chayim, ba'atanya niret sam amavet. When it comes to radish, some call it the potion of life. Some call it the potion of death. Lokasha, the Gemara answers there, not a problem. Kam bimot hachama, kam bimot hagshamim. Depends if you're eating it in the summer or the winter time. It seemingly means that when it's in season, it is good for you. When it's not in season, it is not good for you. Beish lamar, the mar yehocha, be'eit shehu sam chaim, the time that it was the potion of life, be'od, yesh svarim begarsi hatam, there is another answer that's brought in that gemar, which is kan ba'alim, kan be'imahot. Depends on what you're eating from the radish. You're eating the leaves, or are you eating the bulb or the root that is associated with the radish? The radish itself is the root, and then you have the leaves that grow out of it. And so the suggestion would be that the imahot are positive, the olam, they're always a positive food, whereas the leaves are negative sometimes, maybe in the winter or the summertime, or they may be negative all the time. So that would solve the problem. But then he brings the big question, which is, Avagab de Amrinan, Shirabi lo ne'ele min olam. The Gemara at the end of Tubot, it speaks about the death of Rabbi. Over there has a lot to say about Rabbi and his character and his anivut. And one of the things they mention is, lo ne'anem in olam mazeh, afilo etzba ketana, that he didn't get any benefit from olam mazeh. So then how do you square that with what's being written in the Gemara over here? He didn't get enough. What's going on when his table is full of these things all the time? The Tosafot gives an interesting answer, which is, mikol makom ochlei shulchano hayu rabim, that he was the Nasi of Eretz Yisrael, and he had to support a large entourage. He wasn't just taking care of himself. He was taking care of a large political machine that he was running in Eretz Yisrael, both Tamidim and Tamidei Chachamim, as well as his political connections and the people that were servicing him in that area. So he was taking care of them, and that's what's being spoken about here. The Tosafot maintains that Rabbi didn't get any benefit like that, whereas his underlings were the ones that were benefiting from this tremendous wealth. The other way to deal with it is to say, what does it mean? Does it mean that he didn't get any benefit from this world? It means that he didn't get any, call it, ostentatious, extravagant type of benefit in this world. He enjoyed what he had. It's much more like a Hasidic thought about elevating the mundane, or taking that which is an olam hazeh and being mekadesh it. So yes, he ate, and he enjoyed what he ate. That doesn't mean that he was nenem in olam. He got the benefit because it was purposeful in its benefit. It wasn't just some benefit or physical pleasure in that way. And that's another way to deal with that stira between what is said about Rabbi and Ketubot and that what is said over here. The other thing to note is, Shelo pasku mishulchanam snon, Bali Tosfot point out, ein ze rebuta. That's not a big deal. We're talking about lettuce, radish, and gourds. These are all pretty cheap items. Truth is that if you get them out of season, maybe that's what they were playing on in the Gemara. But the Bali Tosafot say this doesn't seem to be something so significant or extravagant that you would give a compliment to someone about their wealth or their political position based on what they had on their table. But he says here, Ela shayu merbim sudat shulchanam, says that these were indicative of the fact that they had very large meals. And since they had such large meals, since they were eating so much, they needed these items. They needed appetizers, they needed digesters, as well as and expanders to deal with all the food that was there. So these are not the reason that we are saying they're so rich. These are the siman. The sign they were rich is because they needed these items to facilitate their ability to have these large meals, or to partake in these extravagant type meals. So that's how the Bali Tosafot deal with what seemingly are insignificant items, and that the Gemara plays that into something being, wow, look at their wealth. It's because of what it facilitated, not because they themselves were something so unusual. All right, so now the Gemara moves on in the Mishnah, which as we dealt with so far, Yom Kinusaya, and now we're up to Yom Aleda v'Yom Amita, day of birth and the day of death. In the Mishnah itself, there's a machlok between the Chachamim and Rabbi Meir with regards to death. What is the problem, whether there is a problem or not? Rabbi Meir says that the death is a problem, whereas the Chachamim say that only if it is a death that includes Sreifa is it a problem. A death without Sreifa is not a problem. So Gemara says about that, Michlal, the Rabbi Meir Savar, Loshna Mita, Sheesh Bas Sreifa, Loshna Mita, Sheein Bas Sreifa. Doesn't matter whether they had a sreifa or didn't have a sreifa. Rabbi Meir would think that it is palchi bala v'dat kochamim. It was considered to be a worship of avodah zarah. Alma sreifa lav chukahi. From Rabbi Meir, it sounds like the sreifa is not a chok, because otherwise it should be determinant in deciding whether this is avodah zarah or not. Michlal, the rabbanon sabrei sreifa chukai. That implies that the rabbanon disagree and think that the sreifa is a chok. What the Gemara is referencing to over here is ubichukoteim lo telechu, that you may not follow in the ways of the non-Jewish nations. And so what they're suggesting over here is that Rabbi Meir does not think sreifa is a chok, and that's why he says any death involves worship of avodah zarah. Because the chachamim differentiate between sreifa and not sreifa, and indicating that sreifa is something of significance here that causes it to be associated with avodah zarah, which implies that sreifa is a chukah over here. You should just know, the Gemara over here is mintayek out of Rabbi Meir and then into the chachamim, which is a little strange only because it's not Rabbi Meir's position that tells you this information. The derivation of what we're saying now is solely from the chachamim's position. The real proof of what they're looking for is from the chachamim, which differentiate between with a sreifa and without a sreifa. Independent of Rabbi Meir, you have that diuk. And you can see that in the Rabbeinu Chananel, he brings matnita yom leida yom mita divrei Rabbi Meir chachamim marim kol mita she'en ba sreifa v'chulei shmamina the sreifa chukat oved kochavim hi. Meaning that the Rabbeinu Chananel skips the step of Rabbi Meir in the Gemara and goes directly to the position of the chachamim to get that, which is the truth. Rabbi Meir is not really relevant to the discussion here. He becomes relevant in the next stage, which is when the Gemara is trying to figure out what they're arguing about. But in the first stage, you can't be medayek what Rabbi Meir thinks about sreifa. Meir says that death has a avodah zarah associated with it. What does he think of sreifa? We don't know, because he's telling you that it's a sur whether you do or don't have sreifa. That doesn't mean he doesn't think that sreifa is a chok. All it proves is that he thinks that death has a avodah zarah associated with it. When you go to the chachamim's position, who differentiate between sreifa and not sreifa, there you can prove that sreifa is a chok according to the chachamim, or at least surmise that that's what they are saying. And you can see that in the Rabbeinu Chananel, where he skips over the discussion of Rabbi Meir's position and jumps straight to the Chachamim's position to make that diyuk. But then the Gemara says, "V'hatanyo, how can you say that sreifa is a chok? Sorfim ala milachim, velo mitarchei emori. You're allowed to burn the possessions of the king, and that's not classified as darchei emori. V'yichukahi, if it really is a chok, v'anan heicha sarfinan. How could we participate in these types of ceremonies if it really was a chok? You're not allowed to emulate the practices of the non-Jews. And if it really was darchei amori or a chok, then how could you engage in this activity? How could we burn the possessions of someone who's of significant stature or of the king? It would be unacceptable. Ella the kuleyama sreifa lav chukai. You have to conclude that sreifa is not a chok, because otherwise we couldn't practice it. Ella chashivutahi. It's an indication of the significance of the burial that is taking place. And this is the machlok between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim. Over here now it makes sense to discuss Rabbi Meir, because you're trying to understand what sreifa does that Rabbi Meir believes it doesn't do. Rabbi Meir sabra loshna mita sheyesh basreifa. Loshna mita she'ein basreifa. Rabbi Meir says it doesn't make a difference whether the death involves it's sreifa or not. Palchi ba'avodat kochavim. They worship avodah zarah in the process of the death, and that is both on the day of the death and possibly in the commemoration of that day of death later on. Rabbanan sabrei mitei sheish basreifa chashiva lohu. So again, it's not the siba, it's not the reason, but rather the siman. It's the sign that this is a significant burial that involves worshiping avodah zarah. The sreifa itself is not the avodah zarah. The sreifa is just indicative of the fact that there is a avodah zarah because this is considered to be someone of significance. Upal chiba, and therefore they're going to worship a avodah zarah. She'en ba sreifa lo chashiva. There's no sreifa, that means that it's not a significant enough burial that they will involve a avodah zarah. And therefore lo pachila. There is no worship, there is no avodah zarah in that instance. If you go back to the Mishnah, the Rambam, the Perush of Mishnayot, and Rashi similarly on the Mishnah, but they're obviously heavily influenced by the Gemara over here, as well as the practice of Jews to do this as well, which says that they burnt the possessions of the individual, not the individual himself. So it was a funeral pyre, not to burn the mate, but rather to burn his possessions. And it was a practice that was common then and all the way through the Middle Ages. When the king passed away or someone of significance passed away, it would be inappropriate for someone else to sit in their throne or to use their scepter or to ride on their horse. How do you indicate that? You get rid of them after they pass away. The same problem that you have, for instance, if you have a great Talmud Chacham or a Rosh Yeshiva that passes away, that's sat in a particular location. So what do you do with that location after they passed away? Nobody feels like they should sit in that seat or fill that seat. Maybe the next Rosh Yeshiva can do it. But there is a possibility that that seat remains empty because of that greatness of that individual. So how do you take care of that? They used to burn it. They used to get rid of it. So that was the kavod to the individual who passed away. So that's why Rashi, and the Rambam in particular, mentions that it was kelim, and it was the items. The truth is that the practice in Rome, and especially with the emperors or the Caesars coming later on, they used to burn the bodies as well in the pyre. That is for two reasons. One is a practical reason, which is, that's how they got rid of the mace. In their day, there was a disposal mechanism. They didn't bury. They burnt. They incinerated the bodies to get rid of them so they didn't have to deal with all those metim, especially given how high the death rates were, mortality rates were. There was a lot of burying you would have to do, and so they burnt everything. That's one practical reason. Well, it's also believed at a certain point that that was a part of the worship of the spirits or the Avodah Zarah, that the burning of the individual would cause their spirit to rise in the practice of the Avodah Zarah. And that's clearly part of what's being mentioned over here with regards to the Sreifa, which is that they're not only putting on the pyre the objects of this individual, the individuals themselves were on the pyre. Just when I was looking into it, Antoninus Pius, who we discussed yesterday, might be Antoninus, he was unusual in the fact that he was not incinerated as death, but rather buried in a sepulcher in the temple that he had built for his wife. And so he was unusual that he was actually buried as opposed to his predecessor Hadrian, who he burnt and was incinerated so that his soul would go up to heaven, and that there was a practice in the Roman Senate after that point in time to deify the emperor once they passed away. And that's part of why Antoninus Pius got his name Pius, supposedly, is because he petitioned the Senate to get Hadrian the status of a deity. And then they burnt or incinerated the body as part of that process. So what's being discussed over here is probably both, which is that the funeral pyre involved both the burning of the objects of the individual, as well as the incineration of the body. Obviously, in the Jewish practice, it only involved the possessions of the king. They were not incinerating the body of the king. So the Gemara here goes through two stages. The Gemara went through a stage where it thought they were arguing about whether Sreifa is a chok or not a chok. The Gemara then concludes that Sreifa is not a chok because we practice it. And then it moves along and says, okay, the machloket between them is whether Sreifa is indicative of Avodah Zarah is not indicative of Avodah Zarah. Some of that might come from the fact that they burnt everything. Be that all bodies were incinerated. So how do you know that this incineration involves Avodah Zarah? And that might have been the machloket between the Chachamim and Rabbi Meir is the incineration an indication of Avodah Zarah? Or is it just a practical way to get rid of the body? And then maybe the confusion, or maybe even the machloket, is about the fact that they're not just burning the individual, they're burning the possessions along with it. And what does that mean? Or it could also mean a difference in time, which is that over time it devolved from being something where they were just burning the king's possessions out of kavod for the king, and then it became more of a deification and a spirit than they might be speaking about, maybe even different times or transition period in which things are changing. The second thing to deal with here is a stira between this Gemara and the Gemara in Sanhedrin. That stira is extremely important with regards to how you view the Isser of Hukol Toyem Lo Telechu. How you reconcile that stira governs how you will look at this Isser and actually has huge halachic ramifications. The Baalei Tosafot already raised this and say, how is it that our Gemara over here comes to this conclusion if the Gemara in Sanhedrin seems to come to a different conclusion? Those would ask, Vatema, my kaparich. What's the Gemara asking over here? If it's a chok, how do we do it? That's what the Gemara wants to know. Dilma, the olam chukai. Maybe it is a chok. Vekeva dichtivi baoraito. Since it's written in the Torah, lo gamrina minayu. We didn't learn it from them, we got it from our Torah. So maybe that's enough that it's written in the Torah, which seems to be what the Gemara in Sanhedrin says. The Gemara in Sanhedrin has an argument between Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim with regards to the mitah of Herek. How do you carry out Herek? The Rabbanan say you do it with a sword. Rabbi Yehuda says you do it with a kupitz. The reason Rabbi Yehuda says you do it with a kupitz is because they malchut. The Roman government, when they executed people, used the cherev. And that's ubukukutayem lo teilechu. You can't use a cherev to put someone to death because that would be emulating the Roman government. So Rabbi Yehuda restricts it. The Chachamim say, how can you do that? killing someone that kupitz is minuval, something that is disgusting, it's something that's messy and not the way that you want to go about doing this, because you want also kamocha, you want to give them an easier death. In the end, the Gemara says that we're not really copying them because the sword is written in the pasuk. With regards to Irani Dacha, it says that they have to die the fecharev, that they have to die by the sword. And then the Gemara learns that Nakomi Nakame by killing, that there's also a requirement for cherev, for the sword. Based on that, the Gemara says it's written in the Torah, we did not copy them, they copied us. And so therefore it's mutar. So now that's what Tosafot says, I have a stira now. Gemara in Sanhedrin says if you find it in the Torah, you're carte blanche, you can do whatever you want because it's in the Torah. Gemara here says, well, if it's a chok, then we can't do it. What do you mean you can't do it? We're about to bring a pasuk from Sefer Yirmiyahu that shows that that was the practice. Tosafot goes here, doraita, but what he means is in Tanakh. We have this practice way before the Ovid Kuchavim have this practice, or at least we have a pasuk that says that's our practice. So why is the Gemara worried about it being a chok? We have a pasuk that says it's mutar. How do you reconcile between the Gemara there and the Gemara here in terms of what is the requirement to remove hukot ha'akum? Gemara there seems you just need a pasuk in the Torah. Gemara here seems to indicate that it's a chok, hands off, you can't touch it. So Ella, what the Tosafot says is, Perishri, the Trey Gavnei Chukahavu, classic Balei Tosafot. There are two types of chukim that you have. It's very dinim. Echad shosim l'shem chok l'avodat kochavim, v'echad shosim l'shem da'at hevel ushtut shelahem. So there are two different types of practices. There are practices that are clearly associated with avodah zarah. There are practices that are, whether they're just stam that they do them, you can maybe even claim they're superstitious, or they things that developed over time, but they have no backing and they have no reason behind them. So he says, anything that they do, the shame over that kochavim, that is off limits. It does not matter whether it's written in the Torah or not written in the Torah. If it's a chok, the shame over that kochavim, off limits. You can't touch it. You can't practice it. Even though the Torah said it beforehand. And his proof is, the fact that the Gemara discusses this with regards to the matzevot. The Torah in Dvarim says, no more matzevot. You can only use a mizbeach avanim. You can't use a matzevah because it's sanuay lifnei Hashem, because that's what the Ovdei Avodah Zarah do. Go to Sefer Breishit. Sefer Breishit is full of matzevot from the avot. So what do you mean? It's the Avodah Zarah. We had it before them, and it was done properly before that. Ella, what Bali just would show you is that, even if it's written in the Torah, even if it was a practice of ours, it was adopted and made into something of avodah zarah, we can no longer engage in it. It's off limits now. That's one type of chok. There is another type of chok, which is this chok of v'chutem lo telech, which is not to emulate them. But there you're emulating them not to worship avodah zarah, but you're emulating them to be like them. You are wearing the same clothing they wear. You're doing things that are similar to them, but there's no reason for it. There's no logic behind what you're doing. You're simply just doing it because you want to be like them, or that's the practice that they have. That type of practice, you can override if we already have it in the Doraita. So if we have it in the Torah and it precedes them, then that's the type of practice that you can wipe out. And that's the transition of the Gemara. The Gemara started with a problem of chukdem lo telechu because it's a avodah zarah. That's what the Gemara was thinking. It's a avodah zarah. You can't touch it with a 10-foot pole. It's off limits. The Gemara then backs away from that. It says everybody agrees that Sreifah is not avodah zarah. Sreifah is an indication of chashivut. But again, it doesn't seem like it's a practice that we need to emulate in any way. But we have it written in the Torah already. The Navi brings it. So that means it was our practice also beforehand. And therefore, you can carry it out. That is the distinction that the Balei Tosafot make over here. And then they say, basically, that Gemara in Sanhedrin is riding on the back of this Gemara. Which is that once the Gemara here came to that conclusion, the Gemara in Sanhedrin picks that up and says, killing by the sword, that's something that is not an avodah zarah practice, just a practice that they have, just something they do. That's how they kill people, that's how they put them to death. So now, can we do that? The answer is yes, it's already written in the Torah. So the Gemara in Sanhedrin knows the conclusion of the Gemara over here, that it's not avodat kochavim, it's one of those hevel v'shtot, a practice that has no real basis for it, or not a religious practice, therefore having a precedent in the Torah is enough to justify that practice. So here the Ran deals with this problem in a different way, which obviously has serious implications. Which is the Ran says over here, Sofim ala milachim velo midarchei amori. That's what we're about to say and discuss more in the Gemara, which is you can burn the things of the kings and it's not midarchei amori. Says, why is that? Eina midarchei amori lachush velo taseh kemaseihem. It's not darchei amori that you worry that you're emulating their ways. Lefi, Shlo asra Torah ela chukot shel avdat kochavim. The only thing that was restricted are laws or chukim of the avdat kochavim. Elu dvarim shel hevel ubeteila. Things that are meaningless and have no purpose to them. V'cholam sheyesh bahen tzorech avodat kochavim, or anything that has a necessity for the avodat kochavim or srach avodat kochavim. Aval dvarim shel tam, anything that has a reason or a logic behind it, sharu, they make it mutar. Uvesreifa ala melachim taima ika lisrof lichvodam, there is a reason to do it in order to honor those people. Kleitesh meshan nomar shein adam acher asui hishtamesh b'mashtamesh hu, that nobody is ra'oi to use that possession or those items of the one before him. So the Ran over here does something interesting. The Ran says, unlike the Baal Tosfot in dealing with this tira, he deals with it in a different way. He says, if it deals with avodat kochavim or sarach avodat kochavim, it's off limits. On the other hand, if you find something that's a practice and you have no idea why that is or what is it about, the Baal Tosfot, you have to say, you have to go look in the Torah. The Torah condones it, then you're okay. The Ran says you don't have to get a precedent in the Torah. You just need a logical reason for it. If you can explain the practice, then that's enough to justify doing it. So over here, the Sreifa, what the Ran says is you don't need a pasuk to do it. It would be enough that it's just logical. It's enough that you know what you're doing. The Gemara in Sanhedrin required a pasuk. The Gemara over here didn't require a pasuk. It just said, is there a reason for the Sreifa? My answer is yes. Sreifa shows chashivut. The fact that it was not an avodah zarah practice, and it was a practice that has a reason behind it, that's already enough of a reason to say it's not considered to be uchukotem lote lechu. So that is the chiddush of the Ran. Tosafot says, as long as it's not avodah zarah, if you have a pasuk, you're done. You don't even have to come up with a reason for it. And then the Ran says the other way around. Even if you don't have a pasuk, you can practice it, qualified by only if it is a logical practice, a practice that makes sense. And so that Ran then has influence on what is known as the Shuta Marik. And the Shuta Marik is very influential in our view with regards to Chukot Akom. It's an extremely long tshuva. I won't read the whole thing to you right now. But it is brought in a concise form in the Ramah, who paskins like the Shut Marik. The Shulchan Aruch in Siman Kufayin Chet says, Ein Olchim Chukot Avdei Kochavim. That's the Ramah. And you're not allowed to wear the same clothing, or clothing that is the type of clothing that they wear. That's unique, or something that's unique. It's always unique to them until a Jew starts wearing it. Can't wear their clothing. The Ramah on this says, person has to be differentiated both in his clothing and his behaviors. It's only true if they engage in that activity because of some sort of moral breakdown, which is kamosh nagulu bosh malbushim adumim. They wear red clothing. Behu malbush sarim, because that's the clothing of the royalty. Chodom lezemi malbushia pritzut. But it's a way for people to draw attention to themselves, to be flamboyant in a way, and that would be problematic because it breaches the norms or moral norms. So this is something that the Meshut Marik has, which is actually a chumrah. He says that any practice that is done that abrogates our moral code, something like that, you cannot engage in. So even though it might be something that is innocuous, meaning that there's no avodah zarah with it, might even be something that has a reason to it, but nevertheless, you can't do it because it undermines the moral standing of the Jew. If you have something that has no reason to it, because then you could suspect maybe there's darchei amori. And you don't know, there might be some avodat kochavim in the background to this or in the origins of something like this, like the rubbing a rabbit foot for good luck. Something like that would be midarchei amori. It has no purpose, no reason to it, and it probably has the shemitz of avodah zarah in its origins. So here he says you can't be involved in something that breaks down morally or ethically what we want to represent as Jews. So that's one. Number two is you cannot engage in things that are a chok but have no reason associated with them. That has ringings of the Ran, which is that it doesn't matter that it's a meaningless or innocuous practice. You need a tamba davar. You need a reason to back it up. in order to practice it. If not, we stay away from it. Aval, davar shenagu l'toelet. Things that they do that are purposeful in their nature. Kegom. This is the tshuvat amarik that precipitates. This is kegom shetalkam shekol mi shehu rofe mumche yesh lo balbush miyuchad shenikar bohu shehu rofe uman. The doctors in the time wore a cape that indicated they were doctors. The question that was posed to the marik is, can the Jewish doctor wear the cape? Is that considered to be chukot ha'akum? Because they're wearing a cape. Cape has no meaning in terms of being a doctor. They're wearing it because, seemingly, there's a practice that comes to them without any backing to it, or without any purpose to it. It's simply a piece of clothing that they associate with the doctors. So mutar lelovsho, you're allowed to do this. V'chein shosim mishum kavod otam acher. Whether it's because of honor or any other reason, mutar, it is mutar. The reason being is for what the Shud Marik says, is that the identification of the clothing as identifying a person as a professional or as a doctor is important in his dealing with his patients. And the judge too, that they wear a robe, that is not mikhukot akum, because that shows you the stature, status, or the veneration that is needed to give to this individual because of who they are, and to identify what their profession is and who they are in this setting that we are in. Whether it's in the courtroom, or whether it's in the hospital, the fact that the doctor dresses in a certain way is part and parcel of his presentation to the patient. Might give the patient confidence that this is someone who is a doctor or someone who is a certified doctor, and so that the clothing is not just chukot ha'akum, but has reason behind it. That is the view of the Shud Marik, which the Ramah brings, la'alocha, which again has huge impact for us today, because many of the things that we do that quote-unquote emulate the goyim or have chukot ha'akum involve these types of professional dress or professional types of practices that may not seem to have reason, but are indicative of a standing or stature within the profession. The Bera Gra says, "Kvar katafti shedivrei Aran tmuhim, v'gam divrei Amarik ein nirim." So the Gra, in responding to this Ramah, in responding to the Tshuvat Amarik, says, "I don't think the Ran is right." And the Arik is really built on top of the Ran, which is that if you have a reason, then it's no longer a chok. And the Marik takes that to the next stage and says, it doesn't even have to be that it's an inherent reason in the object. It could just be more generic or holistic type of reason associated with it. And the Gra says that I don't think either of those are right. V'ha'asayif ta'imadika. V'ha'apagav shenitchakti liyashvan. Avaladina lo nirali. Says, even though I tried to resolve those issues with their positions, says, la'alocha, I don't think it's right. V'chein tzofim malachim v'day ta'imadika. Even when it comes to burning the possessions of the king, there's obviously a reason. Bafilu achi parich, dimlo teima achi. If you don't say this, ela davadai hakol asur. Everything's asur. Rak davka l'mod mehem asur. And the problem is you can't emulate or learn from them. Kamo shishanu keva dichtiv lo minayu gamrina. Since it's written in the Torah, we're not learning from them. Lav davka mishum dichtiv baraita okol davar shaynu osim zulatam mutar. It doesn't have to really be written in the Torah. It just means as we have practiced that we would have taken up without them. V'chein b'malbushim, and same thing with clothing. V'divrei Amarik einirim klal. And what the Marik says, it does not ring with me at all. So the Gra here has a chumra and a kula. The chumra is he thinks that the Marik is wrong, and he thinks that the Ran is wrong. Just because you have a reason for doing something doesn't take it away from being chok le'avodat kochavim. The Gra demands that in order for it not to be chok levodat kochavim, it has to be a Jewish practice. Now, a Jewish practice could be for one of two reasons. Either the Torah says it's a Jewish practice, and therefore it is a Jewish practice because the Torah gives us precedent, like sorfim ala milachim, which is mentioned in the Navi. That's a Jewish practice. So there you don't have to justify anything, it's a Jewish practice. Or it is an activity that we would engage in irrespective of what they do. So for instance, let's pick something like Mother's Day, Father's Day, which are, we'll call them, chok of the avodat kochavim, chukei almot. No reason or rhyme or reason to it. But if you think about it from the perspective of the Gra says that if it's a Jewish principle or a Jewish concept or value, then you can be and participate in it. Kibud av v'aim is a central tenet of our religion. So to do something on Mother's Day and Father's Day wouldn't be so bad, although you probably should be every day. It should be Mother's Day and Father's Day according to the Torah. So you could object to it from that reason, but inherently it is a tenet or it is a practice that we would condone in our own religion. And therefore, if they pick it up and they do something similar, it's not called Chukot Akum. So the Chomra of the Gra is, he doesn't accept reason as being enough of reason not to call Chukot Akum. But he opens up the other side, which is, if it is a Jewish practice, or it's a Jewish ethic, or moral, then we can do it as well, because it's something that we would see value in. And therefore, you could practice it as well. Anyway, that gives you just a little flavor for Chukot Akum. And basically what we tried today to do, and try to follow the Gra, which is that we try to figure out if there's some Jewishness to it. And we add on to that, or we do try to also garner with that the Ma'arik or the Ramah to give you those dispensations. We see that the Ramah Paskins, and many people follow that in terms of professions, that a tam or a reason, even though it's not an inherent reason, but a moralistic reason, we do allow for it. And then we do in other places, we try to be choshesh for the Gra, to say that if it's a practice, that it has some Jewishness to the practice, in order to justify that it is not Chukot Hakum. Okay, Gufa. So now the Gemara wants to know, Sofim al-Melachim, Veimbo Mishum Darchei Emori, Shenemar, because it says, Bishalom Tamot, Ubimisrafot Abotecha al-Melachim. Yirmiyahu is telling Tzidkiyahu that you will die, and then you will be in the pyres of your forefathers, the kings. Well, they're not talking about the incineration of the body. When we're talking about a pyre, we're speaking about the burning of the possessions of the king. So you see precedence for that in the Torah or in the Tanakh. Similar to what they do for kings, we do it for the Nasi. I mean, the Nasi in Eretz Yisrael has the same status as the king in the later periods. He was the leader, both politically and religiously, for the community in Eretz Yisrael. And obviously, the Gemara here, in the context of what we're speaking, is thinking of Rabbi, and that he is a descendant of Beit David. He's also a politically connected and leader in terms of his power base, as well as a religious leader, and therefore they get the same status as a melech. Uma heim sorfim ala melechim. What is included in the pyre that you burn? Mitatan, their bed, uklei tashmishan, and their utensils that they use. Mitatan over here either could be their deathbed, or mitatan could also mean their bed, but not the bed in the sense of where they slept. It could be the bed in the sense of where they ate. In the Roman times, they leaned on beds or they sat on couches to eat and even maybe to meet other people. So mitatan would be the equivalent of their seat. Their throne would probably be included. I don't know if mitatan is their throne. It's not usually used in that context. It's hard to know what the word mitah means over here. Umaisa shemed Rabbi Galil azakein is a case where Rabbi Galil passed away. V'saraf alav unkulus hager shivim mane tsuri. And we have a story that unkulus hager burnt in that pyre 70 maneh is 100, so that is 7,000 dinare tsuri with Surian coins, which is a significant amount of money. Gemara says, "V'ha'amart ma'hein sorfim aleihem." Didn't you said before what they burn about them is mitatan uklei tashmishan? Has to be associated with them. Why is he just burning money? That doesn't make any sense. Ema bishivim maneh tsuri. He burnt something that had that value. It wasn't that he was burning money. They burnt the possession of Gilgal Zakein, the object that they were burning, consisted of that type of value. First of all, here you see Unkulus Hager, his contemporary. I mean, he's a contemporary with Rabbi Gamliel as a king. Number two here is an important Rashi. Rashi says over here, Shivim Manet Suri. Suri, Mishkal Shel Tzur. It is the weight or the coins of Tyre. They were considered to be the gold standard in that time. Ve'o Chathei Slaim, a Manet Suri, is worth 25 Sela. Vasela Dalid dinarim. And the sela is worth 4 dinar. So a sela is 4 dinar. 4 times 25 is 100 dinar, which is a maneh. A maneh is 100. So that's the 100 dinarim, and that's what he's saying here, that they had 7,000 dinarim that were burnt. Ve'a dinar mishkal zahuv Constantina. And the dinar is equivalent to the gold coin of Constantine. This is a very important Rashi, because this indicates to us what the sizes of the coins were in the time of the Gemara, as well as what the shekel or the chatzi shekel was in the Torah. Rashi over here gives you that weight because the shekel ha-Torah is equal to the sela of the Mishnah. And that means that the shekel of the Torah is 4 dinar as well. That means that a chatzi shekel of the Torah, or a chatzi shekel kodesh, is 2 dinar, which is the equivalent of a shekel in their time. The sela was the equivalent of shekel kodesh, and the shekel became the name for the chatzi shekel. The Ramban speculates that they did that because they were giving the Chatzi Shekel. They probably minted a coin that
that was actually a full shekel, that was the chatzi shekel, the chatzi sela. Rashi over here claims that that is Mishkal Zahov Shel Konstantina. We have it here. Rashi in Baba Kama, Taflam and Baba Medbet, says, Vashekel Mishkalo Arba Zuhuvim. It's worth 4 gold coins. Shehem Chatzi Unkia. It's half an Unkia the Mishkal Yashar Shel Colonia. In Cologne, he says that those 4 Zuhuvim are equal to a half an Unkia of the currency that we use here in Cologne. The Rif disagrees that Zuza de Shashrang, Hu Dinar Zahav Shel Aravim. It is the gold coin or the Arabian gold coin. The Ramban al Torah in Shmot, Perek Lamed, Pasuk, Yud Gimel, over there argues on Rashi. He quotes Rashi, says, V'kot of Rashi, Sheshekel Mishkalo Arbazuim, Shehem Chatzi Unkiel Mishkal Yeshar Shel Kolonia. So Rashi in Chumash quotes what he quotes in the Gemara in Baba Kama, as well as what he quotes here in the Gemara in Avodah Zarah. The Ramban goes on to explain why he thinks Rashi is wrong, and he says that it might have been right at some point, says Rashi did it in the coins of his time. They deflated the currencies. They reduced the gold content of the coins. And yes, he's using the gold coins that are called these Arba Zuhuvim, but he's using the wrong coins because they devalued the currency. And when they devalued the currency, he's measuring the new currency, not the old currency. So Ramban takes Rashi to task and disagrees, and he emphasizes the Rif's position, like Darko Bakodesh, Ramban is usually in defense of the Rif, against Rashi. That's the end of the Ramban al Torah. The Ramban, we know, eventually makes it to Eretz Yisrael. And Ramban's visit to Eretz Yisrael, he writes back a number of things to his children that are here, I wrote, on what he wrote in the Torah or his Perush on the Torah. One of them has to do with Kever Rachel. He writes back. When he gets there to Israel, he finds Kever Rachel. And that which he wrote in Parshat Vayechi might be wrong because he found Kever Rachel somewhere else. That's a nice discussion. Also in this instance, he writes back to his son. Barcheni Hashem ad kosh zechiti bati l'Akko. I reached the port of Akko. U'matzati sham b'yad zikne aretz matbea kesef mifutach tulei chotam. I found these coins that were written on. Mitzido echad kein makel shakeid. One side is a staff that has almonds on it. Mitzido sheni kein shlochit. The other side has like a pitcher. U'b'shnei tzadim saviv katav mifutach beheretev. There's clear writing on both sides of the coin. Beruah katav lekutim v'karu miyad. Showed the inscription or the writing to the kutim, the locals, and they were able to read it right away. Kihu katav ha'ivri asher nishar lekutim. It's the old cursive Hebrew that we find if you go to the Israel Museum today. You can see that Hebrew that they used back then. And the Kutim preserved it. They still read Hebrew that way. K'moshe Muskar B'Sanhedrin. V'karum min atzad echad. And it says on one side, Shekel HaShekalim. That this is the Shekel of the Shekalim. Mitzad HaNesheni, it says Yerushalayim HaKadosha. It says, V'omrim, Ketzurot, Maklo Shel Aron, Shkadeha Uprakeha. The image that's on one side is Aaron's staff. With the Shkedim and Prachim, Batsura Sheni, Tzinsenet HaMan, this week's Parsha, it is the pitcher in which Aaron stored the man. B'shaklenu oto b'shulchanot, we went to the money changers and we weighed it. U'mishkala asra kesef astralins, I don't know if that's Austrian, but it's the weight of 10 silver Austrian coins. Beim chatzia ukya, shizkiu Rabbeinu Shlomo, and that's the equivalent of the half unkya that Rashi said. It looks like it is made to be the chatzi shekel. Says that this is a heavy proof to what Rashi wrote. Here the Ramban, who very much is a charif and tremendous lamdan, when he argued with Rashi on the Torah, he argued logically against Rashi. Rashi never stepped foot in Eretz Yisrael. He comes to Eretz Yisrael and he finds, like Rashi's right and he writes back, I think Rashi might be right about the weight of the coin. And that's what Rashi mentions over here, that it's Zahuv Konstantina. It is the gold coin of Constantine. And again, that would help us in terms of measurements of what the Chatzi Shekel is. Alright. Umidei Achrina Lo. Wait a minute. Is there nothing else that you burn? Vatanya. Don't we have a Brita Tosefta? Ukrina Lemelechim. Vein Mishro Mishu Melechei Amori. We are okay, and there's no problem of Darche Mori. Amar Papa, Sus Shirachabalav, the horse upon which she rides. Oger is the practice to take the sus, the horse of the king that the king rode on, and to in some way disable the horse so it can no longer be used or ridden on anymore. Ubehema Torah lo. Wait a minute, it's only a horse? You're telling me that kosher animals are not included in this practice? Vatanya. Igor sheish ba trefa asur. If you do igor that causes a trefa, that is problematic. Shein ba trefa. If it doesn't have a trefa, it is mutar. Vezu igor shein ba trefa. What is an igor that doesn't cause a trefa? Haminasher parsotea. Minarkova lamata. Someone who takes off the hoof from below the knee. Because that doesn't make it into a trefa. Minarkova melamalo is a trefa. And you wouldn't be allowed to do it. You're telling me that the whole purpose of this is to speak about the kavod of the king and to disable those things that the king used. So you're talking about the horse that he rode on. Yes, I can explain it in the context of what we said before. So it's not a new item. It's the same thing we said before, which is klei tashmishan. But once you start dealing with animals that are kosher, there's no way you could justify the practice and say it has to do with kavod. Kosher animals are not used for riding on. They're not used for the klei tashmishan of the king. My answer is targma rapapa begla hamoshechet bekaron. It is a calf that is pulling the royal chariot. And so sometimes there are kosher animals that are used in the procession or the king's arsenal, and therefore it would be kavod to disable that animal in order to be kavod towards the king. So the Gemara maintains this position that you're only allowed to burn things or you only engage in burning of items that are a kavod for the king. In that way, these practices are all similar. And what we mentioned is just a paradigm or an example of sorts, but you could extrapolate to other things, including these animals, and we can explain these animals as being kavod to the king. Rashi says over here, why is it that you're not allowed to make an animal into a trefa? Rashi writes, Asur legrom lebeima trefa biyadayim. It's a sword to make a beima Torah into a trefa biyadayim. Rashi brings up an Isur that we never heard of before. Where in the Torah, where do you have an Isur, even in the Rabbanan, not to make an animal into a trefa? Rashi claims that's what the Braita was speaking about. If it's a trefa, a sword. Shein ba trefa mutar. Because you're not allowed to cause a trefa biyadayim. That causes the Balei Tosafot to say, Rashi's explanation here is incorrect. It's not about making it to a trefa, not making it to a trefa. The question of asur and mutar here is whether it's asur ba'achila or mutar ba'achila. What's the problem of making it into a trefa? There's no such isur. What the Balei Tosafot say is, if you do it in a way that makes it into a trefa, asur ba'achila, but mutar ba'hana. If you don't make it into a trefa, not only is it mutar ba'hana, it's mutar ba'achila. Tosafot says, what's the chiddush then? Of course, if it's a trefa, you can't eat it. It's not a trefa, you can't eat it. The chiddush is that that's not a pgam in the kavod of the melech. That we don't consider to be a diminution in the kavod of the king by eating the animal or getting hana from the animal. Therefore, the Balei Tosafot read this completely differently, which is it's about eating, not about an isur to make something into a trefa. Those that defend Rashi say that Rashi likely was saying that it's a problem of bal tashchit. It's a problem of wasting items. You can't just wantonly waste items. There's an isur in the Torah bal tashchit. The Balei Tosafot take that issue up as well and ask, why isn't all this practice a problem of bal tashchit? The Balei Tosafot say that bal tashchit is only true when there is no purpose or reason to what you are doing. Bal tashchit is destroying something with no utility from what you are doing. Here, you're doing it for a purpose. You're doing it for the kavod ha-melech. That's no longer called bal tashchit. Bal tashchit is only when it's done wantonly. Rashi says, or what Rashi is indicating is, that there are different levels of bal tashchit. There's bal tashchit where you can accomplish what you want, but you can do it in a way that preserves the utility of the item. For instance, if you maim the animal, but don't make it into a trefa. And that way you've accomplished the kavod ha-melech, but you're not bal tashchit because the animal can still be eaten. If you go beyond that and make it into a trefa as well, Rashi sees that as being a sur because of the problem of bal tashchit. So bal tashchit want to matir anything. As long as there's a purpose, doesn't matter anymore about what you do because you have a purpose to it, you don't have to hold back in any way. Rashi seems to indicate that there are gradations within bal tashchit, which is if you can accomplish what you want without going to the extreme of complete destruction, then you should use that. And then if you went beyond that, it would be a problem of bal tashchit. So this is actually a fundamental machloket about how you view bal tashchit. Then the Balei Tosafot asks the obvious question, which plagues anybody who reads this, which is, v'im tomar, amay lo parich, v'yikatsar balei chayim. What happened to Tzar Balei Chaim over here? Causing tremendous pain to the animal, in maiming the animal. Isn't that a problem, or why is that not addressed here by the Gemara? So that obviously reflects something about Tzar Balei Chaim. He says, V'yishlomar, Tosu gives the answer, D'shayni kvod ha-melech, Shukavod b'chol Yisrael. That the honor of the king is a kavod for all of Klal Yisrael. V'atik kvod rabim, V'dochi Tzar Balei Chaim. And the Kvod Rabim comes and undermines or overrides Tzar Balei Chaim. So now this is an important Balei Tosafot. Obviously, if Tzar Balei Chaim is only Midrabanan, we spoke about this back in Bob Metzia, Daf Lamed Bet, Amud Bet, so whether Tzar Balei Chaim is go right or Midrabanan. If Tzar Balei Chaim is only Midrabanan, this whole sugya is much easier to understand. The Rabbanan said it's Asur, the Rabbanan are Matir in this situation. They gave dispensations. If you say Tzar Balei Chaim is the Oraita, then you have a much harder issue, which is, how can you violate Tzar Balei Chaim the Oraita for doing something that is Kavod HaMelech? The Balei Tosafot would answer, well, Kavod HaMelech is something significant because it is Kavod HaRabim, because it involves all of Klal Yisrael. And therefore, Kavod HaRabim comes and is Doche Tzar Balei Chaim. It's not clear whether Tosafot is saying that on a rabbinic level, or he's saying that even on a the Oraita level. But this does have serious implications about Tzar Balei Chaim, and this is brought by many, many of the poskim with regards to animal experimentation, with regards to plucking feathers off of a chicken when you're going to get it ready for Shechita. And here many of the poskim point out that Tzar Balei Chaim is only problematic when it's done for no purpose, when it's done without a reason. If there's a reason for what you are doing, it's no longer governed by Tzar Balei Chaim. And that has to do with the way that there's a hierarchy in terms of Breshit, which is, you're not allowed to waste, you're not allowed to have Baal Tashrit with regards to animals and with regards to creation. On the other hand, man sits on top of the creation and is given the right to manage creation and to use creation for his purposes. And therefore, what they're saying is that Tzar Balei Chaim is suspended in a case where there's a purpose to what you are doing. Of course, just from a human and moral standpoint, you try to minimize that Tzar Balei Chaim, but nevertheless, if there's a purpose to what you're doing, we don't consider Tzar Balei Chaim anymore, and it's overridden. And that seems to be what's implied in Tosafot over here, and that is the way that many of the poskim go, especially, again, modern poskim like the Tzitz Eliezer and others, when speaking about animal experimentation, they say that Tzar Balei Chaim is not a consideration, because it's something that's l'toelet adam, and in that case, there is no problem with Tzar Balei Chaim. Of course, again, minimizing it is important. And that's why some say over here, the Isser against the Treifa is that that is too much of Tzar Balei Chaim. Meaning that you're allowed to have Tzar Balei Chaim up to a point that you can accomplish what you want. To go beyond that and make it into a Treifa, that's unnecessary. The same way that Rashi says it in Baal Tashrit, you could say the same thing in Tzar Balei Chaim, which is the Treifa and not Treifa is an indication of how far you can go or what you're permitted to do. You have a limited scope of what you can override Tzar Balei Chaim for, which is the thing that gets to the purpose that you want, the utility you want. To go then beyond that and make it into a treifa, that would not be acceptable. That's too much Tzar Balei Chaim for no reason. All right. Now we're continuing the Gemara. Yom Tiglachat Zekano. The day that he shaves his beard, we saw already in the Mishnah that there was a machloket rishonim as to whether this only refers to the king or this refers to lay people as well. We saw the Rambam, the Rashi and the Raifad have all different views within the Mishnah. What is written in the Mishnah? The Mishnah writes two things. It's the Yom Tiklachat Zekano, as well as the Blorit in the Mishnah. So now, is there a connection between the two? Is it Yom Tiklachat Zekano, the day that he shaves, Vanachat Blorito, and on that day he also leaves his Blorit, Odilma Yom Tiklachat Zekano, Vahavarat Blorito? Or is it the day that he shaves and also takes off his blorit? So now, let's just discuss this. Shaving was not something that was done very frequently. And when they did shave, they had a big celebration associated with shaving. Number two is blorit. Blorit, and this is very common practice worldwide. It probably was picked up by the Romans from Eastern practices, but it became something that was spread throughout the Roman Empire. And was a practice that was adopted by many. The origin was from Avodah Zarah, but they adopted it in general. And that is that they used to take interim haircuts during the year. Those interim haircuts were just to cut the side of their hair. Like they would shave a little bit, they'd also cut the sides of their hair, but they would leave the hair that was in the middle, equivalent of a little bit like a mohawk. They would have the big bunch of hair in the front and a ponytail in the back. Once a year, they used to cut the hair on top, the blorit. That cutting of the blorit was associated with a avodah zarah or a chag avodah zarah that the person had. So that's what the Gemara is trying to clarify over here. We have Yahu Teglachat Zikano. Is that Teglachat Zikano Ba'anachat Blorito, which means he's cutting his beard, shaving the sides of his head, but leaving the blorit on top? Or is the Yom Teglachat Zikano also the day that he cuts his blorit? I mean, where is the restriction? Is the restriction just when he shaves normally? Or is the restriction only when he shaves in the context of also cutting his blorit? Tashmat Dematanyo Tarvayu. We have a Braita that has both. Yom Teglachat Zikano Vanachat blorito, yom tiglachat zikano, vavarat blorito. So here, the Braita separates out and says, shaving, whether in the context of leaving his blorit, or whether in the context of cutting his blorit, both of them are problematic. Amar Rabbi Yehuda Amar Shmuel, od acheret yesh lahem b'Romi. There is another practice that they have in Rome that is not mentioned in our Mishnah, that is a chag, that should have been mentioned because it's a chag d'avodah zarah. Achat b'shivim shana. It happens every 70 years. So the truth is that there was a Roman practice which were called the Century Games, which were every 100 years, they used to have a big festival, Olympic Games, and all sorts of theater, wonderful celebrations every 100 years. The truth was that they didn't track it so well, so it came out a little short of 100 years, and they probably came up roughly around 70 to 100 years, and that's probably what's being discussed over here, was this huge celebration that was put on every century. Here the Gemara describes part of that practice. Mevim adam shalem, they bring somebody who is able-bodied, makivin oto al adam chiger, and they have him ride on the shoulders of someone who is lame or has trouble walking. Umavishin oto bigdei adam arishon, they put onto him the cloak of adam arishon, uminichin lo brosho karkiflo shel Rabbi Ishmael, and on his head they put the face of Rabbi Ishmael. So let's deal with all what we saw so far. It's a lot already. The first thing is that this represents Yaakov and Esav. Yaakov is represented by the Chiger, because Yaakov, after his fight with the Malach, is Soleya al-Yerecho. He's limping. So that's the Chiger. So the Chiger is on the bottom, and on top of him is the Adam Shalem, who's representative of Esav. So this is a statement of the ascendancy of Esav above Yaakov, and that's why Esav is riding on top of Yaakov. In addition, the face of Rabbi Ishmael is from the story of the Asara Hurugei Malchut that we read on Tisha B'Av and on Yom HaKippurim. Rabbi Ishmael, Kohen Gadol, who was put to death together with Rabbi Shimon, they throw lots as to who goes first. Rabbi Shimon goes first. Then Rabbi Ishmael, when they go to kill him, the daughter of the Kesar says, he's so beautiful, can't you spare him for me? He refuses to spare him, but he says, I'll give you his face or his head, so they peel off the skin and he screams out when they hit the place of the tefillin. Rashi notes it over here, they preserved his face in formaldehyde, or in their day, they call it afar simon, they embalmed the face so they could bring it out, and they would bring it out on this occasion to wear it. Rashi makes an interesting comment, I don't know where he knows it from, or how he knows this is the case, but he says, v'adai munach b'ginzei romi, this karkafalo shel Rabbi Shmuel is still found in the storehouses, treasuries of Rome. Again, a sign of the ascendancy of Rome, the ascendancy of Esav. Vitalu v'tzavere, and he used to wear around his neck a necklace of matka resh zuza defiza, something that weighed a 200 zuz worth of fiza, which was some precious stone. Rashi says, paz, v'emen yikara ad ma'od, v'enu matzui ba'olam. It was such a precious stone that nobody found it. And in Rome, they had one that was 200 zuz weight, and they used to wear it on his necklace. Umechapim et ha-shvakim be'enach. And then they decorate the stores and the marketplace with, again, we saw before, enach was associated with either shoam or nofach, which means that it was either carbuncle or onyx. Umechazim lefanav sach kirei plaster. And they call before him, see, Rashi, I'll just give you the translations. Sach means the plan or the strategy. Kiri means either a master or a prince. Plaster is a liar. Now, it's interesting the word plaster is used to lie because plaster covers over what is below it. So maybe that's the origins of the word. because it hides that which is below it. It makes it look like it's smooth or makes it look like it's nice. This is cheshbon hakatzin kasabhu, that the strategy or the ploy that the prince put to place was false. As the Rabbeinu Chananel says, Vomrim, Sach Kere Plaster, Plaster Belashon Yavan Ziyuf, similar to what Rashi says, Uperish Kere Adon, similar to Rashi, Uperish Sach Achi, the brother. So he translates Sach as the brother, rather than Rashi, who says that Sach means the plan or the strategy. As Rashi says that Cheshbon HaKatzin over here means Nevuat Yaakov, the Nevuat of Yaakov that Kara Lebanav Lachrita Yamim, that he gave to his children, telling them about the end of days and the ascendancy of Bnei Yisrael, and that they will be redeemed. Kazavu, it's all a big lie, because look what's going on over here. This is the biggest proof that what Yaakov said will never come true. Rashi claims that it's associated with Yaakov, but if you look in Balei Tosafot, he says, Persha Kuntres, Shekorim Yaakov Kiri, Veloni Hirashir Karula Yaakov Adon. Doesn't make sense that the Romans, who see Esav as their ancestral father, why would they call Yaakov, who is his competition, an Adon? But rather, he thinks Perish Rabbeinu Tam Ze Yitzchak Shekorim Kire. That is Yitzchak that is called Kire because they believe that Avram Yitzchak and then Esav is the way that the things go. So Esav is their forefather, and then they give respect to Yitzchak. So it would make sense that they say Kire about Yitzchak. And according to that, it would be that Yitzchak's plan to flip the bracha or the bechora, it didn't come true or it failed. Achua demarana zaifano. The brother of our master is a falsifier, a forgery. So here they're speaking about Yaakov's taking of the bechora from Esav. It says over here, the strategy, what he intended to do, did not work out. Achua demarana, the brother of our master is Esav, his brother is Yaakov, zaifano. He was a forgery, a trickster. He tried to steal the Bechora. The Chami, Chami, or the Lo Chami, Lo Chami. If you see it, you see it. If you don't see it, you don't see it. That's because something that happens only once every 70 years, there's a likelihood of you seeing that in your lifetime twice. Very rare. Because most people didn't live till 70, but even if you lived till 70, the last time you saw it would be when you were a baby, and now you're 70. So a person to see two of these would be very rare. And again, the Centurion Games had this phrase that was said about it. You better come, because you're not going to see it again. My ahani l'rama'a b'ramute, l'zayfana b'zayute. What helped the conniving one in his conniving, and what helped the forgerer in his forgery? You know that Yaakov tried to steal the Bechora. In the end, we're Esav, and you can see that we're ascendant. U'misaymin b'hochi. And they ended this way, which is very interesting. Vai v'dein kad yakum dein. Woe to this one when the other one arises. Meaning, woe to Esav when Yaakov arises. Amravashi, Ikshulan PM, Lurshaim. Their mouth caused them to trip up. It's almost like Poteach Pele Satan. Their own mouth describes what their end is going to be. I Amru Zaifana Achua Demarana. Had they said that the brother of our master was a forgery, but the words before in this way. Zaifana, he's a forgerer, the brother of our master. Kidamre, they'd be right. Hashadamre, Achua de Marana Zaifana, that they say the brother of our master is a Zaifana. Marana Gufe Zaifanu, the master himself is a Zaifana, is a forgery. If you look at the sentence, you could parse it in two ways. You say, Achua de Marana Zaifana, the brother of our master who's a forgery. Or it could be Achuna de Marana, the brother of our master is a forgerer. Depends where you put the comma in the sentence. That's what Rav Ashi is pointing out. Had they wrote Zaifana in the beginning of the sentence, it would be unequivocal. Zaifana, forgery, Achuna de Marana, the brother of our master is a forgery. On the other hand, if you read it the way that they put it, you put the comma after Achua, that makes Marana into a Zaifana, Esav into a forgery. And therefore he says their own mouth tripped them up in declaring that their master is a forgery. Or I would even say that the last statement that they made, woe to this one, when the other one arises, is also a predictive in nature that they will rise again. This is only a temporary state. Why didn't our Tana include this in the list, in the Mishnah? He only enumerates things or holidays that happen every year. that doesn't take place every year, he does not enumerate in the Mishnah. Hana de Romai. The holidays that we mention here in the Mishnah are the Roman holidays. Gemara is acknowledging that the Mishnah is speaking in a specific context and a specific time period, and saying that the holidays mentioned there are the Roman holidays. Ute Parsai Mai. What are the Persian holidays? Mutradi, Veturiski, Muronki, Umaharin. In a Chubata Geonim, the list of these Persian festivals is Musradi, Muharniki, Triaski, and Macharit. Over there, he writes that the first and third of those are no longer kept, which would be the Musradi and Triaski. And he says that Muharniki, which is our third one, but his second was actually a celebration at the beginning of the summer or the beginning of the winter. Or others suggest that it was the rain festival. It was a festival leading into the rain season. And the last one, which was called the Maharid, or for us is Moharin, is actually the festival of the new moon. And so two of those festivals in Persia were still kept, and it's hard to identify them given how many girsaot and transliterations that we have of the holidays. But here you see from the Tubat Gaonim, at least two of them, they said were still in practice, and they identify them. So these are the Persian holidays. Again, they'll give me a list of what their local Avodah Zarah holidays are. Hani the Parsai Udoromai. Those are the Persian and Roman holidays. The Bavlai Mai. What are the Babylonian holidays that are problematic in terms of Avodah Zarah, that you can't trade with them on that day and beforehand? Moharniki, Va'aknite, Va'chanune, Ve'eser, Ba'adar, which is the 10th of Adar. Those are Babylonian holidays that would be under this restriction that is our Mishnah. Amrav Chanan Barav Chista, Amrav, Amrila Amrav Chanan Barav Amrav, Chamisha Batei Ovdei Kochavim Kivuin Heim. There are five fixed houses of Avodah Zarah. The Gemara will ask later on, what's the meaning of that or why is that relevant? Elohim, Beit Baal Bibavel. So Beit Baal Bibavel, Baal, is the major or primary god of the Babylonians. And they had a huge temple that was erected in his honor. It was destroyed by the Persians, but then later rebuilt, and was there for many centuries, this temple to the Baal. And Baal is also synonymous with the temple of Marduk, who might be familiar to you because the name Mordechai comes from the leading god of the Persians, Marduk. So the Baal of the Babylonians is the Marduk of the Persians, and that's what's being noted over here, that temple that is to either Baal or to Marduk. Beit Nevo Bekursi. Nevo is also a Babylonian god, and some suggest is the Chaldean Mercury that was considered to be in charge of or ruling over writing and prophecy. And they identify Kursi as Gerasa, Gerasa, which is synonymous with Borsip, where there have been ruins of temples that were discovered. And there was a huge tower that was built in the city of Borsif in his honor. And actually, we saw that in the Gemara in Sanhedrin when the Chachamim were speaking about the towers of Borsif. It was a reference to this tower that was built for the Avodah Zarah of Nebo. And would have been something that the Amoraim who lived near Borsif in ancient Babel would have been actually witnessed to or known about. And it's interesting to note that the word Nevo also appears in some of the famous Babylonian names, including Nebuchadnezzar. Nevo is the beginning of his name, which is that God was incorporated into the name of Nebuchadnezzar. Tirat Shebemapag. So the Tirat is a Syrian god that was centered in the city of Mabog. Srifa Shebashkelon. Srifa might be an adaptation of Srefa, and that would be the burning deity, or maybe Venus. Nashra Shebarabia. And Nashra, probably from the word Nesher, is an eagle, or something that represented an eagle. These are five places that are Avodah Zarah Kvuot. Yad Ravdimi. Ravdimi came Osipelein, Derid, Shein, Bechi, and Nadbucha Shebaako. Ikadamre. Some say Nitbira Shebaako. So you read it's usually associated with a market. Shein Bechi is actually a Roman city up in Lebanon, Heliopolis, and there they had large centers of Avodah Zarah. There were many temples that were built there, and this obviously is one of those temples, or was a temple or Avodah Zarah that was active all year round. Nidbuchat is a stone or a foundation, whether it means there was a stone, that means that there was some sort of sacrificial mizbeach that was there, or whether that was part and parcel of the Avodah Zarah itself. Or otherwise, we'd have to say that Nidbachai is synonymous with Yerid. Rav Dimi, Minarda, Matne Ipcha, he had him the opposite way around. Yerid Shibako, and Nidbacha Shein Bechi. Amarle Rav Chanan bar Rav Chista, my Kvuin. His son says to him, what is the meaning of the fact that they are Kvuin? How does that change their din? Le'ochi Amar Avua Dimech. This is what your grandfather said, your maternal grandfather said. Kvuin Heim Le'olam. Tadira Kvula Shata Palchilu. So what does it mean? Kvuin Heim means that they are in constant worship. They are constantly engaged. That means all year round they are worshiping them. And they are classified as a Chag L'Avodah Zarah at every day. And that means you cannot transact with them. You cannot interact with them because of the problem that they are always engaged in Avodah Zarah. It's not a unique holiday on a particular day where they're going to go to their Avodah Zarah. This is something where their practice is to go every day, or they're engaged every day. Therefore, you can't engage with them at all. So the important thing that comes up over here, which we don't have enough time really to get into, but is just worth noting, is Nashra Sheberabia. Nashra Sheberabia, it's not clear what that is, and there's an argument amongst both the scholars as well as the Rishonim as to what it is. Whether that's associated with the Nesser, the Beit Nasrach, that the Gemara in Sanhedrin on Daf Tzadivov, Amud Aleph discusses with regards to the Pasuk in Melachim Bet, Bayu Mishtabeh Beit Nasrach Elogav, Vadar Melech, Bishar Tzar Banav, Hiku Becherev. There the Gemara discusses about that being the board from Noach's Teva. So if you associate the Nashra with the Nasar, or the Nasrach, that would be one possibility that would make it into a Avodah Zarah. The Oroch brings as the explanation for Nashra, Perish Kon Yesh Berebi Abayit, Ubeit Avodah Zarahu, Vid Ba'evin, it has a stone in it, V'chokukala, and there are carvings on it, V'sogdimla, and they bow down to it. In Muhammad and the Origins of Islam, a book written by Francis Peters, he there discusses the fact that the origins of Mecca come from something along the lines of what was being described here by the Oroch, and that would then connect Islam with this previously idolatrous practice. The reason it has implications is that what is the status of Islam with regards to Avodah Zarah? We've already seen the questions with regards to Christianity, how the Baalei Tosfot and many of the Poskei Ashkenaz are trying to walk it back from being Avodah Zarah. The Poskei Sfarad clearly see Christianity as being Avodah Zarah. And you really have a breakdown along those lines. With regards to Islam, you almost have the opposite breakdown, which is that the Sephardi poskim are saying that it's not a Avodah Zarah, and the more Ashkenazi poskim are more apt, even though they don't all say this, are more apt to say that it is a problem of Avodah Zarah. The argument revolves around this, Nashra Sheberabia, whether it's associated with an area or a place that eventually evolves into an Islamic temple. Was this a precursor to Islam? And if it was a precursor to Islam, that would indicate the Gemara thinks that it is Avodah Zarah. So that leads to a major machloket about what this Nashra Sheberabia is, and the implications for it are what are the status of Islam. Again, whether you can then say that what morphed into Islam is also dictates what the status of Islam is, number one. And number two is whether this really is, because the name is slightly different, that it might have been a predecessor to Islam or a temple that preceded Islam. Amar Shmuel, Begola, Enu Asur, Eloyome Dam Bilvad. So this is a statement we saw from Shmuel already, that when it comes to the Gola, only the day of the holiday is restricted. Biome Dam, Nami Mi Asir. Wait a minute, since when is even the day of their holiday restricted? Rabbi Yehuda, Sherle L'Rab Bruna. And you can see here the alternate Girsa, as whether it was Rab Bruna, the Rif has it as Rab Kahana, and the Rosh has it as Rab Nachman. Rabbi Yehuda allowed Rab Bruna, Lizbunei Chamra, to purchase. Again, in the Gemara, it's hard to know when the Chamra could be wine, or it could be a donkey, more likely donkey, because wine would have other problems associated with it. Well, Rav Gidol is one chitim, and he allowed Rav Gidol to buy wheat, b'chagta detaya, on the celebration of the merchants, or the chag of the merchants. Gemara says, shiny chagta detaya de lo kvia. The merchants' holiday, they used to do it once a year, to celebrate their successes, or celebrate their trade. But they didn't always keep it. They didn't do it every year. They didn't do it at the same time. It was something that was more amorphous. And therefore it doesn't take on that status of Avodah Zarah, because it's something that they let go by. So how serious could they be about it If it's not a practice, that's a consistent practice. So that's an important factor over here, that that's not considered to be a chag l'avodah zarah if they do something that's just a temporary or a willy-nilly type of practice that they don't really continue, it's not really involving avodah zarah, there you don't have to worry about transacting with them. Now again here, why is it that Shmuel says that the only restriction is the day of their celebration, not the days before? Rashi over here brings two reasons. We discussed this back on Zayin Amud Bet. Rashi says here, "Ein anu yecholim la'amid atzmenu milisar le'itinim mehem." We can't stop transacting or trading with them. Shebeneihem anachnu yoshvim uparnasatenu mehem. We live amongst them, and our parnosa comes from them. Rashi is very practical over here. We need them in order to get our parnosa. And therefore, if you restrict 3 days before, you're going to sink the Jewish ship. Forget about them. We're not going to be able to survive without it. And we can't do that. Vod mishumira. And the other problem is, we're scared of them. If we do this and they get wind that we're doing it because of their holidays, they're going to penalize us. They're going to take retribution on us. Back on Zion Amud Bet, Rashi also commented on that statement of Shmuel. And there he brought two reasons as well. One is, mistafina minayu. We are embarrassed or afraid of them. That's the same as the year over here. But there is an additional reason, which is, Eino de kochavim adukim kochach babudat kochavim. The avodah kochavim of today is minagavotam b'yadayim. They're not so steeped in their avodah zarah. So Rashi gives three reasons why we practice only to worry about the holiday itself and not the days before. One is our pranas is dependent on them. Number two is their avodah zarah is not real avodah zarah. It's more like minagavotam b'yadayim. Number three is eva or ira. There's a serious issue that they could take retribution on us if we continue to not trade with them because of their holidays. Next Mishnah. Ir sheyesh ba avodat kochavim, chutz olam mutar. A city in which there is avodah zarah, the suburbs that are around it you can transact with and you can trade with, they are not governed by the avodah zarah of the city. Haya chutz olam avodat kochavim, if there is avodah zarah outside the city, meaning the suburbs or the areas of the periphery are celebrating their avodah zarah holiday, tocha mutar. Then the city itself is mutar because they're not dragged on by the suburb. Maul elech sham. Are you allowed to go to that city during the celebrations? Zmancha derech miyuchedet oto makom masur. If the road just go to this particular location, you can't get on the road, Rashi says, mipnei hachashad. People are going to think you're going to the celebration, you're joining in the avodah zarah. Ve'yachol alech ba lemakom acher. If this road has more than one destination to it, then it's okay, mutar, because it doesn't necessarily indicate you're going to the avodah zarah. You could also be going to the other city, and therefore it's not a problem of chashad anymore. We'll stop here by the Gemara on the bottom of Yud Aleph Amud Bet.